Hello, this is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And here we are at the nearly at the end, please let it be nearly at the end of a blazing summer. Roger won't be happy until he's 6 feet deep in snow, but the rest of us are just hoping for a little bit of rain, please, rain.
We had some last night, we had some this morning.
And that must have been nice for those who were awake. This time we're going to talk about ships and shoes and sealing wax and cabbages and kings. We're going to have a gallimaufry or general go at some prompts from an institution on this podcast. But first, here at Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, the nice people at the Bundle of Holding send us previews and free samples of their work and what they've got coming up. And if we find it interesting, we will have a chat about it. And Roger has found something interesting in this current offer. Roger, Blue Planet.
Yeah, so 29 years ago.
Ah, how time flies when you're having fun!
The first edition of Blue Planet came out. Then the second edition came out 3 years later, and then 12 years after that, there was a second edition revised, each of which has been with a different publishing partner, I should say, except the original, which the company did, the Biohazard Games did themselves. This is now a new publishing partner again. It is Blue Planet Recontact. It is another entirely new system. Which I think it is
traditional by now. Yeah.
They have kept in some material from the original book, but looking at the credits, they're quite careful to distinguish new content from old content. So I don't think the original guys are still writing it. I mean, it was 29 years ago. Fair enough. This is a game of hard science fiction, at least by the standards of when it was written. The one big obvious miracle, which is interstellar travel.
Yes.
But it's very limited and expensive, and there's basically only one place you can go. Earth is a mess. Poseidon, which is the one place you can go, is less of a mess.
And blue.
Largely covered with water. So there are sapient dolphins uplifted. There are humans adapted to be able to breathe underwater. There are people who don't go underwater because they're boring. There was also the... Due to, as far as I recall, to some unfortunately timed wars, there was 60 years of isolation after the original colonists had landed, before anybody came back. And some of them have gone a bit weird.
Okay, so
but I'm
this
sure
is
fine.
It'll all be fine. Everything will be fine. This is a work. Is this a work of optimistic science fiction or pessimistic science fiction?
Ooh. Rough, broadly optimistic, I would say.
Yeah.
Certainly, it is. While there are various surgically implanted technologies, this is not cyberpunk, for example.
Right, which is a miracle.
Given that it was obviously inspired by something like that to some extent. But yeah, I mean, there are definitely bad guys, and you may have to do something about them, but you can. So, yeah. So this is the... They call it, I think, the third edition. And the rules are interesting, because they say they wanted to bring the... learn from more modern game designs, because the second edition was, let's face it, quite like the standard game of the era. So what you have is kind of Fate-like in some respects, where you have a skill, you actually have a triplet of things.
Mm-hmm.
For example, and they go in ascending order of specialisation. So one of the examples they give is lawyer, politician, immigrant, sympathiser.
Okay.
They are not necessarily cascading. So the politician will be able to do stuff that the lawyer couldn't, not just better than the lawyer can.
Yeah, that sounds like promotion until you reach your point of incompetence.
Well, yeah, specifically not that. So the lawyer will be able to do lawyer things, the politician will be able to do politician things. There are things that one of them will be able to do and the other can't in both directions.
But the same person is going through all the steps.
They're not going through this. This is the thing you have on your character as a triplet of stuff.
Okay.
And as well as actual skills implied by that, there are also implied contacts, social connections, that sort of thing. You might have Poseidon Native as your base level thing, and that is not just, you know, I know the geography and the society and stuff. It's also, I might at least have some idea where the black markets are. I know people know me. I have a home village. I can name that, and people will care about what it is. That kind of thing. So
I'm not sure that's modern, but that's definitely newer than first.
Well, Fate counts as a modern game, I guess. Don't ask me where Fate came out. I'm not even going to look it up for the show notes.
Sure.
Anyway, so that seems to be the main thing. I have had a skim through this. What we've got in the bundle, I should say. Let's just have a look. There's a player's guide, moderator's guide, a quick start, which is some pre-gen characters and adventure and a quick introduction to the rules, a reference sheet and a PDF form character sheet. So, yeah, fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the system, and it does feed into things because generally the system is... You will roll some number of dice against a target, which is defined by your stat plus your skill.
Mm-hmm.
But the number of dice is defined by where on that skill hierarchy you are. So if you're doing the very specialist thing, as in this case, immigrant sympathizer, then you will roll three dice, and effectively it's a dice pool. You have three chances to get the success.
Okay, I'm not sure that's what I mean by a dice pool, but carry on.
I define the term dice pool very broadly, as see previous episodes.
Okay, fair enough, go on.
The point is you roll multiple dice and you don't add them together, you test each of them against the target map.
Yeah.
I haven't tried this. They do the one thing that I ask designers of dice pool systems to do, which is include a probability table. It's not a super complicated one. So if you are GMing this and saying, here is the difficulty of your challenge or whatever, you have some idea of that. It's stat plus skill plus difficulty of task modifier, basically.
I think I see, but I'm not sure which way
everything feeds into the same number, which is a really good thing. Because it means you have only one lever to pull back and forth rather than having to move it left and right as well, which gets confusing.
I'm not even going to try to parse that analogy. So where is the fun in this for you?
I heard about this game. I believe I skimmed this game when the first edition came out. I've never actually played or run it.
I'm one better off than you, since I never even read it.
There was, I should say, as well as the three previous printings, there was a GURPS conversion in 2003.
Yeah.
So that is a GURPS third edition conversion, of course, but that's out there as well.
Yeah.
I find the system interesting. I like the implication that there are some truly alien aliens. It's only an implication. They don't say stuff explicitly in what I've read. I like the whole, here is a really weird environment and at the same time, we're adapting to it and it is adapting to us.
Okay.
And that is a thing I enjoy.
Okay.
It's also science fiction that's taking the time to explore an individual planet. They give you some astronomical details, but basically this is a thing about being on a planet, not a thing about operating a spacecraft.
Yeah, I have. The spacecraft coming in are purely background sources of new characters and maybe a threat in some other future, I suppose. Any spacecraft, when you don't have the ability to shoot them down, can be a threat. Yeah, all right. I can see why. I do agree that concentrating on one individual world, a single world, ought to be enough for anybody. But, yeah.
I also have, through previous bundles, but through various means over time, most of the earlier stuff for the previous editions. And as far as I can see, while the hard numbers aren't going to be particularly useful, there is no reason why you couldn't use the plot elements. I don't believe they have updated the plot particularly.
Okay.
At least on a quick skim.
Right, well, this is clearly trying to revive a previous fandom and trying to create more interest by having a newer, perhaps easier to use system. I can't say I feel totally attracted, but hey, there must be people out there who want to get their feet wet.
Thank you. It's a science fiction setting that isn't about going zoom and blast, and that always gets points with me. But anyway, this is on the bundle of holding until the 7th of September.
All right, a good long run.
It is, as we're recording, August. And what that means, and since the very first one of these happened, which somehow we found out about, even though we are terminally out of touch, that means it's RPG a day.
Didn't we skip one? We skipped the one that was mostly visual.
Did we? Anyway.
I think so.
But in any case, it's that time again. Rather than make 31 individual little posts, we're going to have 31 individual segments here in the next however long it takes. We call it RPG a minute. We never go that fast.
No, true. We sometimes don't even go that fast for one of the entries. We'll do our best this time.
But in any case, number one is discipline.
Which has two meanings, one of which is welcome to gamers and one of which is not. I actually, when I say gamers, I mean players rather than GMs. The first meaning is being under discipline, being under control, being subject to punishment if you do things wrong. And by and large, because these games are rooted in power fantasies mostly, I don't think that's true for good society.
This is where I say the long shadow of the Western. Again, just assume I'm saying that a lot.
You may murmur it quietly in the background. The response in all cases is to be the rogue, the maverick, the cop who does it his own way. The British are slightly more subtle than this, as we've noted before, inasmuch as they think it's fun to be part of the discipline and to subvert the authority of their superiors by disrespect and generally being a barracks room lawyer. I actually had one volunteer to be the officer in my last military-focused game, and I would like to say to Alan, he doesn't hear this very often, you did a bang-up job there, Alan. You played the young officer doing his best to deal with a bunch of rogues in his squadron and to get along with the political authorities. It was very lovely. I mean, I've been listening to it to write up the last episode for E&A, and he did a bang-up job. The other meaning is a course of skills which are connected together, a discipline in martial arts or, for that matter, in ballet dancing, for all I know, and that the players love because it's another thing that allows them to do something special, another shtick for them. And the question of realism I come up with is, can you get to the second sort without going through the first sort first?
Well, in a game, you can simply say, I learned this before play began. You know, I spent 27 years balancing on one leg in the monastery, and now I can disassemble you with my little fingernail.
You can, yes. And I think it's up to the GM to bring your old teacher, old sensei, in to take you down a peg or two, to be honest.
I would agree with you that it's often neglected in game, though I'm thinking of the Royal Navy in Space game, in which you were a player. Yeah. And I do think that it was slightly more relevant there. Certainly, I know people who are... I think the general attitude I meet is not so much I will subvert this from within as this is a useful structure which is going to keep us alive, though sometimes the bloke in charge isn't going to know what's going on sufficiently well to make a decision, and sometimes I'm just going to have to subvert it to deal with that.
Yeah, that is known as the sergeant's... Oh, was there something you wanted to say, sir?
And this is one of the points where the competent officer learns that if the sergeant is acting to do something, that is not because the sergeant is self-interested if he's any good. It is because this is the right thing to do and he's in a position to sort it right now rather than going through the chain of command. And
yeah.
One of the officering skills, of course, is telling the difference. Though I would also say out-of-game admin...
Yeah.
Needs some discipline because it's dull and you can, in theory, go into the game without having done it. As I have said before, I think in a traveller trader game, there is going to be some space accountancy. Ideally, you want a player like me who enjoys doing the space accountancy.
Yeah.
Stature. In game, not a thing that comes up much, I think. I mean, I suppose you've got size in BRP derived systems. Mm. I remember the adventure in, I think it was the Games Workshop RuneQuest 2, which may have been somewhere else first, which had these various stat checks, including can you squeeze through this particular bit of the passageway in the dungeon?
Yeah.
And it was the one stat check that was in reverse. Should it matter more? Perhaps it should. Most of the games I play and run have people who are mostly human sized.
Yeah.
It is an obvious way of distinguishing somebody. And it's a cliche perhaps, but the player who wants to play the great big warbot, you're not going to fit through doors, mate.
Yeah, I when thinking about this, I noticed that I have memories of people making short jokes about other players' characters, but not of making tall jokes, and I don't know why that is. Maybe nobody wanted their character to be called Lofty or to be particularly tall, but or maybe it's just that the person who's bigger than you can bash down on you, and the person who's shorter than you can only back your ankles.
My experience of both dogs and drunken idiots in pubs is that large blokes generally don't feel they have anything to prove, whereas short blokes often do.
Right. Well, that's maybe why I don't go to pubs anymore. Third.
Well, don't go to pubs with drunken idiots. You need people a good go pub.
The people go to pubs to become drunken idiots.
No. People go to pubs to socialise, and the drunkenness is a side effect which is largely to be avoided. If it's a good pub. That's a whole separate thing, which I'm not going to get into.
Yeah, it's not on our list.
We've got people saying, save the pub from their preferred political point of view, and they are not specifying whether they what they regard as a good pub, and there are a whole lot of different things that could be. But anyway.
This is why we don't get it done in a minute. Third.
Yeah, number three, poise.
Poise is has a sense of waiting on the edge of action, ready to act. It also means style. Being centred and focused on the moment. It's the quality of a man with good presence, good people-impressing skills. It's the quality of a fencer, waiting to draw his blade, waiting for the opponent to strike. But for most people, want to play a muscle-bound thug. I mean, all right, maybe not most people, but the muscle-bound thug is simpler. My first RPG character was a muscle-bound thug, and I had fun with him for a little while. I'm not sure any of the martial arts systems that we have actually reflect this inner quality. But it's a very good note for making a character definite and real. A character, but you have to be able to play cool in order to have cool in this context. And that's difficult.
I think the first system I saw that had a real go at making this work was probably Man to Man, the precursor of GURPS, which was definitely trying to say you can be an agile fencer who avoids getting hit, or you can be a slow bloke in armour who can withstand the damage, and tried to put those on an even footing, which obviously, historically, they aren't particularly, but never mind.
I think it very much depends on circumstance.
Yeah. Static dexterity, I guess, might be a way of summarising it.
I think it's more a matter of perception, and therefore of wisdom in modern D&D, of being aware of yourself and of the environment. It's carrying yourself well, and I don't carry myself well. I lumber nowadays, but I do admire it as a quality, and it's something that you teach actors to do, to move across the stage well and to be in the moment all the time.
It's certainly a thing I've observed people with more skill than me in martial artists, also in ballet dancers. A ballet dancer who is sitting down having lunch with their friends will, in my experience at least, generally still have that I'm completely aware of everything that is going around me, and if I need to move, I will make the minimum movement that gets the job done and disturb my balance as little as possible, even when they're just sitting down having a drink.
True that. 4, charm.
Now, I thought about this as there are some universal roles that work in many role-playing games, like the big thug, as you suggest. Being a charisma monster, I don't think, is one of those roles, because basically you can't do it in D&D. You can do charm spells, but if you can do charm spells, you can do lots of other things too. You may recall the Savage Worlds game in which I discovered all the things that would add to my character's persuasive ability and ended up getting all but one of them. That one being Noble, which the GM would not allow me to take for obvious reasons. But he got to the point of, essentially, as long as he could come up with a reasonably plausible thing to say, he could persuade most people of it most of the time. And that to me, is one of the universal roles that characters fall into. In GURPS, it's quite an easy one to do as well.
Yeah. It's a difficult one in many ways to play if you haven't got the talent to improvise dialogue and improvise... But there are and improvise excuses, but there are always mechanical means of doing it. If you have a player who wants it but can't do it, does it strike you that the spell meaning of charm bleeds over into the skill meaning of charm? That some people treat being able to persuade other people as a form of mind control, almost.
I think I would try to avoid players who were that creepy. I'm thinking of it as it's one of several social skills in, for example, Call of Cthulhu, or some editions. Don't ask me which editions. But you know, you can charm someone. In other words, you're being nice to them about it, or you can intimidate, or you can harangue, or whatever else.
Yeah.
And This is the thing I always find a little odd in GURPS, because it doesn't really have just try to persuade somebody without doing one of those other things. And diplomacy, I suppose, to some extent, but diplomacy is a kind of specialised thing in itself.
Diplomacy is a fail-safe skill in GURPS. It's there to ensure you don't actually do badly and upset the other side. It doesn't help you make your case. It helps you not fail at it, which is valuable, I think.
But it is harder to learn than the other social skills for that reason.
Yeah. I find, I have to say to players, especially running modern RuneQuest, no, that's not a charm roll. That's an intimidate or that's a fast talk roll. And they are very different things, and you should let them roll for the thing they're trying to do, not for the thing that they happen to have the highest skill in.
Yeah, I will admit that a big part of what I suppose I could call my meta system, the layer that sits between me and the players and the actual game system is I prefer systems in which I can say to a player, think about your character and who they are, what they would do in this situation, and tell me.
Yeah.
And I don't want them to have to be thinking in terms of which skill do I use or what modifiers can I add to it or whatever. I mean, that may be there, but it should flow out of the thing that they're doing. If they're doing a thing that they're good at, they'll be better at it. Now, obviously, they can read their character sheet and say, right, I'm good at this and not so much at that. That should flavour what they do. But I do then expect them to pick the actual thing, not just say, I'm going to use my charm skill.
Yeah, but there are some interpersonal interaction skills you can't use in a particular circumstance. You do not attempt to intimidate His Majesty.
You can try. I hope one might be able to say something like, you've noticed that everybody's faces have gone very, very flat and the guards are looking at you.
One of them has his hand on his sabre.
Burden.
Oh, God, do I have to talk about encumbrance systems?
Encumbrance is dead.
No, it's not. No, it's not. It's not dead. Well, any player anywhere wants to load himself up with a full blacksmith's workshop and put it in his backpack, and there will be such a player, I do assure you. It occurred to me that the other sense of this is the weight of social responsibility. And I wondered, fruitlessly, I didn't develop the thought, whether you could use the model of only being able to carry around so much weight in a particular form, use that to model the burden of too much responsibility, too much of the world weighing on your shoulders. But it was only a poetic thought, and I didn't take it any further.
Well, certainly you could use something like the GURPS system, where there are steps, there are increments,
yes,
and the more increments of whatever you have, the less able you are to do other things.
Perhaps. Yeah, penalties, top limits on mental stability roles. If you are carrying too much social responsibility, too much weight, it occurs to me that we do tend to reuse game mechanics from in different contexts than we originally intended them.
Remember Lace and Steel, which had a quite interesting card-based dueling system, which was also used for having a duel of wits.
And a duel of magic, and, yeah, it was... no, the magicians had their own deck. But it was... you can do things that way. As long as there's some resource to use and some chance of exhausting that resource, then this might be a useful idea.
Thinking about the physical thing, I think the idea of adding up weights has very much gone out of fashion, partly because modern players are regarded as being completely averse to anything that smells like calculation.
Even addition and subtraction? I take a point about multiplication and division, but addition and subtraction?
Well,
I may be going into my old fellow rant at the sky any moment now.
People look at, say, a GURPS equipment list and say, what do you mean 0.3 of a pound? What's a 0.3 or whatever? Anyway, the thing that has often replaced it in an attempt to try to keep things reasonable is what I call item count. You know, you can have one medium item, one small item,
yeah,
that kind of thing. But that just gets silly.
I've also seen things like the Mouse Ritter system, where you have various slots of, you can put this on your head, you can hold this in your hand, you can wear this on your body, but the overall amount you can carry, and you can only carry one really heavy item. Yeah, I've seen things like that, and yeah, they're very speedy and often give a sense of the reality of the thing.
I saw something recently, I can't remember whether it was at a bottle of holding or somewhere else, where you had different shaped blanks on your character diagram, and in this particular place you could only put a triangle type item.
Hmm. Depends on the, how they classify the triangles, I suppose. Number six, reach.
Okay, so we were talking earlier about characters of different sizes. A famous bijou bug et in GURPS Dungeon Fantasy is that while a player character can be a human or a great big ogre-y type or a tiny pixie type, they can all reach the same distance above their heads.
Yes. All right. Well, maybe they were just...
Simply because they said, you know, that it's this much rather than this fraction of the character's height. Yeah? Not unreasonable. But more seriously, I think that when you have a look at the map of the setting, if it is at all possible, there should always be unknown places that you can dream that you might go to one day. Even if you never do, they should be there. Ludovic Chabant, whom I follow on Mastodon, has recently been looking at early RuneQuest, and he's mostly looking at RuneQuest 2, but he's got as far as the map of Lorantha, and this is the one with the grey edges.
Yeah.
It basically says, things out here get weird.
And we haven't quite determined how weird they're going to get yet.
And he's then looked through maps of from later editions, and most of those don't have the grey edges. And as far as he's concerned, and I find myself inclined to agree, is saying, yeah, here is stuff that's not documented, that's not even maybe understandable to you guys. It's weird, and maybe you can go and look at it someday. That's good. I like that.
I recall that my friend Hartley has... Our world, which he runs RuneQuest in mostly nowadays, which is a flat plane with actual edges, and our characters got to go to the edges and look out, and that was weird too. And so, speaking of Chaosium, they also had or have a feature in Glorantha, which is blank lands, the places where they're not going to officially publish anything for it, and it's there for individual GMs to develop and put down their own ideas. And I think that's something, yeah, lands beyond, places off the map, is something you probably want in most pre-industrial or fantasy worlds.
For that matter, one of these sectors on the Traveller map is canonically, we will never publish anything for this. I can't remember now what it is, but one of them is definitely defined as that. Which obviously also means you can make your own connections to it in games that happen elsewhere. Number seven is Mercy.
Mercy, Lex Luthor's bodyguard. Also a quality that most RPGs don't have, or only as a tangential relationship. Pendragon has it as a central feature. It's one of the five, I think it is, Christian virtues of the true Christian knight.
There is no canonical list of Christian virtues, but yeah, I tend to like the seven of faith, hope, charity, justice, mercy, fortitude, temperance. But
yeah,
that's only because I can remember it.
Well done. It should be seven. It goes. It's a parallel with the seven deadly sins.
That's why it was invented. Yeah, and then there's a lot of argument about.
Well, they had to have faith, hope, and charity because you know that's in St. Paul. But yeah, it's often at odds with justice and with revenge, especially in the medieval paradigm. Hamlet is all about revenge and not at all about mercy or justice. And I feel it would have been more interesting play if either of those. Actually, there is a scene in Hamlet where Hamlet has the opportunity to kill Claudius or show him mercy, and he does neither of them. And it's a very central point to the play.
Let us also remember Board of the Rings, which is not as good as it should be, but it has its moments. Ah, 'twas pity stayed his hand. Pity I've run out of bullets.
Yeah. And we should notice the RuneQuest mechanic of Ransom, which is there to encourage mercy.
And it's very common in historical settings as well. Yeah, there is an obvious reason to do that. Have you been reading the forum this morning?
Not this morning, no.
We've been talking a little bit about the degree to which PCs tend to be unrestrainedly violent. And my feeling is that to some extent this falls out of the system, because if the only way to stop someone fighting you is to kill them, or at least put them to a point where they will die if not aided, in other words, your classic D&D, then that's what you're going to do. Whereas in something like GURPS, there is often a wide range of you are now unconscious and maybe bleeding but not in immediate danger, or you're pretty messed up but you're not going to die immediately.
And there are also
I think what flows out of that is that now we can actually take prisoners.
Yeah. And there's also disarms and stun guns and what have you. I would like to point to Rain, the core setting of which has a bit of the setting which says, if you murder somebody, you are going to be haunted. They won't be able to harm you, but by God, they will nag and distract you to death. You want to be very, very careful how you kill people, preferably from surprise so they don't know it's you. Resolve.
Yeah. I think it's good to have a sliding scale of resolution detail in a game. Mm-hmm. If we want to resolve this in excruciating detail because it really matters, we can. If we just want to say, you're pretty good at that, you'll manage it, we can do that too.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have to do this with the players and the GM on the same side. Otherwise, everybody has an incentive to say, I want to use the mechanism that will favour my preferred outcome.
Yeah. I mainly use hand-waving for things in the background that don't matter. The things that in the background that do matter, I tend to use a single dice roll or one dice roll per side per round to let things flow a bit. There was a grand battle between two of the villains in the setting at the climax I've just written up of my RuneQuest campaign, and the player characters stood at attention the entire way through, deciding nope. It's not our responsibility. No. The elephant isn't our problem. No. The Imperial Guard can handle that. No. All right. Everything's sorted out. We can get on with the parade now.
I'm just thinking of the phrase, let's you and him fight.
Yeah. What is next?
Privilege.
Privilege. Another one of those things players love to have and hate to have held over them. It means, I'm told, private law, literally, and means some power, some right that applies only to some people. Only the 00 section are trusted with the license to kill. Only samurai may carry the two swords. And we are, though we're tending towards oligarchy, in which you have to check somebody's credit balance before you tell them no. At the moment, we are in a fairly egalitarian, fairly socially loose sort of society in the West. And people who say, do you not know who I am, is like a red rag to a bull to some people.
Have we talked about the Admiral Rickover story?
Which admiral was Admiral Rickover?
He was the guy who basically got the US Navy using nuclear submarines safely.
All right, how did he do that?
By being a complete bastard. But he was very well known as, we'll shout at anybody for any reason, and we'll ruin your career because he doesn't like you. Hmm. As well as doing some actual good stuff for the organisation. So the story goes, he comes up to a submarine tied alongside and starts walking up the gangplank, and the sentry says, halt and identify yourself. He says, do you know who I am, son? Yes, sir, you're Admiral Rickover, sir. And if you don't halt and identify yourself, you'll be the deadest goddamn admiral in the Navy, sir. History does not record what happened, whether it was promotion or nobody saw him again. But in any case, I think of privilege as, at least for the sort of character I tend to have, what makes a villain a villain.
Oh, that's very anarchist of you.
The only reason they cared was because they were forced to, and now that they're not forced to, they don't care anymore.
I think I tend to regard privilege as a character forming booby trap for the person who takes it up. That there's always somebody above you bearing down on you. That with great power comes great responsibility, and there are people around to remind you of that. So,
and the child who was never told no does not come out well. unless they have unheard of strength of character from some other source.
Yeah, I think we could point to current politics, but I'm going to restrain myself because I've done the politics bit for this podcast.
The flip side of that is us. We have money for games. We have places we can run games. We have time that we can run games.
We are a semi-privileged class in a very privileged culture. Maybe we're at the top of our apogee and about to fall, but I don't entirely believe that. I am full of hope still. There will be games in the future and people to talk about them, I believe. What's next? Mercy, resolve, privilege, secret, Roger.
Everybody has things they don't want known, and this is normal.
Yeah.
It is important, I think, to have people who have minor things they don't want known, as well as the big, important, plot-relevant ones. In a mystery story, that there's a classic thing that many writers do of suspect A is clearly hiding something, they're not telling the truth about where they were or whatever. And eventually it comes out that this is not because they were the murderer, but because they were sneaky off to see their illicit girl, boy, whatever else, friend.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And generally, in a mystery story, once that is revealed, you know that they're not the murderer, because people are only allowed one sin each, basically. Not always, but often.
Yeah.
And I think it is important to have that kind of, maybe they're not telling you everything, but not just because they're the villain. Maybe they've just got some other reason, something they care about.
Yeah, I think the red herring should still be relevant to the solving of the mystery, ideally. But pure red herrings are allowed. I thought about secrets was that most times in my games, where players have chosen to have a secret, it's going to be quickly shared with the rest of the players. But I can trust my players to not act on that knowledge outside what the story allows. And one of the player characters, it's in the final write-up, which I'm doing now for ENA, in my RuneQuest game, had a chaos feature. And it was not revealed except by GM Fiat at the last moment. And all of the player characters kept that and just ignored the fact that he healed quickly and recovered from blows that other people probably wouldn't have done.
As chaos features go, that's a pretty benign one. I mean, not a tentacle inside.
Yeah. If he'd got a leg chopped off and he stuck it back on, they would have noticed. And it might have interfered with any serious healing he needed. But it's nonetheless... And he was part of a chaos-tolerating culture, but he knew enough to know that there are people out there who do not like chaos, and some of them were his own teammates. But yeah, that's normally something I trust the players to treat discreetly, and not reveal before the story lets them reveal it.
Yeah, I think back in the day, and by this I'm talking mid-80s. There was lots of talk, I remember, about separating player knowledge from character knowledge, and it was generally assumed, I think, certainly by me, that this was a thing that a competent role player simply would do. But there were definite arguments that, no, I shouldn't have to.
Yeah. I'm also terrible at keeping campaign secrets. I want to show off my cleverness about the central twist of the campaign, and I want it to get revealed sometime. But sometimes I don't have one, and that's healthier.
Also, while I'm going to keep it out of play, I do find it can be interesting if there is something that is going to be revealed at a particular point, but we don't know exactly when. It is sometimes interesting, depending on the player, to let the player have some idea of that, so that they can set up their character to react in a particular way when it does come out.
Foreshadowing is another technique we
should
talk about.
Yes, entirely in the metagame.
How do you do that? How do you say to a player...
Well, I will simply talk well out of character with the player and say, is this a thing? You know, your character seems as if they would react to this particular thing in this particular way. You know, here is some advance warning so that when it does, here is some idea of how it might go. You
know? I want any information passed to be passed in the game, and I want the player's reactions as I want my reactions to be fresh and in the moment.
It depends on the character.
Suppose.
I'm just not writing this out. I don't usually do... I said before, I don't like the having to switch between playing the character and being an author/editor.
Yeah.
But given that this is entirely out of character, I find it is occasionally useful. But in any case, tacked, by which we do not mean nailed down.
Yeah. T-A-C-T, tacked. This is the awareness in the social sphere that a ballet dancer has in the physical sphere. It's being aware. You can do it only if you are aware of the subtext, or even a knowledge that there is a subtext, that there's a mood here that isn't out in the open. In real life, I suspect I've always been a bit clumsy at this, of not being aware of the feelings of people. I hope I've got better in old age, but I wouldn't guarantee it by any means. It's also useful at the gaming table, because though they don't look it sometimes, gamers are people too, and they have their own feelings and their own concerns, and you probably should not tread on them too hard.
We have moved on beyond the days of White Wolf's Wraith, I think it was, in which the GM was explicitly encouraged to find out what the players were afraid of and surprise them with it. No,
yeah.
Don't do that.
No, don't. X card, warners. Is there anything you don't want me to do is now considered polite, and I think it is. It does restrict you a bit, but I think it is polite.
I've been doing it since I found out about it, which was some time after it had become a thing, but not, I think, very long. And honestly, I have not yet found it constraining, but hey.
On the other hand, being tactless as a character trait is a lot of fun to play.
Can be, though it can get dull. I think I tend to overlap this a bit because I was quite lacking in tact when I started gaming. I have whatever ability it is that some people get through other means to, you know, read a room and notice when somebody is being annoyed or irks or whatever and change course, was not something that came to me naturally. I had to teach myself to do it. I know some people who have not taught themselves to do it. They are, without exception, middle-class white men with, you know, reasonably good jobs and plenty of money and so on. You don't get deferred to very much these days. I realise that what I did for myself is not a thing that everybody can do for themselves. Some people genuinely cannot manage this, but please try.
There is a something to be said for formality, though it is a pain in the arse to remember all the details. What's next? Loss.
Well, I think there is this assumption that the RPG is a constant upward journey, the power fantasy, if you like. We talked years ago about the idea of having a campaign on the downslope. But I think even without going to that extent, it's good to have setbacks sometimes.
Yes. Robin Laws talks about the cycle of up and down, of winning beats and of gaining beats and losing beats throughout the... But Players aren't very, in my experience, players aren't very good at being philosophical about losing, and they will kvetch. But on the other hand, there is a thing about failing forward, which you can pull, which you can say, well, we failed at that, but that just sets us up for the next thing. It's better if the players see the next setup for themselves, and you don't have to say it out loud. But if it's going to get the story moving on, say it out loud. Well, there is this other thing you haven't yet investigated.
Yeah, I think this may also be another lobe of the long shadow of the adversarial GM, because certainly I know players who will have their characters literally fight to the death against a minor inconvenience rather than suffer the trivial loss that would come along with it. You know, somebody picked my pocket. I will murder every pickpocket in the city until I'm sure I've got the guy.
Yeah, that's fun as a long-term project, but it isn't going to get the narrative any forward now, is it?
Yeah. Strain, number 13.
All right, well, this immediately turned my mind towards Forged in the Dark. In Forged in the Dark, strain is a stat. It's a resource which you spend as you, with the bold criminal and rogue, attempt the various criminal enterprises and jobs. And you use up the strain on your nerves to get yourself forward, and you can overreach and find yourself overdrawn at the strain bank, overdrawn on your nerves.
Somebody mentioned this in Ever and Anon a few issues back, the idea that strain should be a bad thing that you don't want to have too much of, but in Blades it's a thing you don't want to run out of.
Yeah, and... strain both means your capacity to bear the strain and the burden that you're putting.
Yeah, that's the problem. It's not at all clear which way you want it to be moving.
Well, it is clear once you've played it a little while. This is a general mechanic which I think we find again and again in role playing. You have only so much of this precious thing, whether it's nerves or luck or...
Yeah, call it nerves. I wouldn't have anything like the same problem with it.
Or luck or something. And you want to spend it just enough to win, but you don't want to overspend it or it will do you in.
Mm-hmm.
And in Blades in the Dark, I've got to say, it works rather well.
Yeah, I was also thinking of Blades in the Dark for this because, on the one hand, I will absolutely agree that adventuring is hard and you want to take a break sometimes. And in many settings, that is a thing that the characters can do. But I would much rather actually play it, at least a bit of it, than say, OK, I made the role, I had a good time, now I'm ready to go back to the job.
I think you can always storify those interludes. You can work them into the ongoing narrative.
I had a read through Blades after our game ended, and it didn't really seem to suggest that that was a thing it supported. But anyway, the other thing I want to say is I have burned out on role playing 3 times.
Hmm.
And each time it has taken the form of I just have no idea what I'm doing. When I'm running a game, when I'm preparing for a game, I can go through the motions, but I have no idea why I'm doing it. And I have to rebuild that from not quite from scratch, because obviously I have the recollection of what I've done before. But I've had to reconstruct the reasoning each time. And it is, frankly, a bizarre experience, which I try to avoid doing again. So I'm quite glad that our recent campaign has just ended before I take on running another game for a different group.
Yeah, you have to give yourself rest and recuperation. It probably shouldn't involve going down to the local temple of evil and indulging yourself. We generally advise against that sort of behaviour, and it's bad for the reputation of the hobby.
The temple of evil is the safest place to indulge my particular vice, okay?
Yes, we know that. Don't wave it about, they'll all want one. But the point, that you're quite right, I don't let it get quite that bad now. And I do know that if I go away from role-playing for a while, which I haven't had to do for decades, but if I had to go away for business or whatever, then I would feel the itch starting again. I'd start scribbling notes and putting down ideas and reading new rule books, for goodness sake. and it will come back. I do get the same, why am I doing this? What am I doing here? Are these people actually enjoying it? I get stage fright, which I never got as an actor. I get it as a GM. But yeah, the urge rebuilds itself. And so the most I do nowadays is become a player and watch somebody else suffer for a while. Next is Rigard.
The word dragon ultimately comes from the Greek derkasthai, which is to see clearly. The GM has to see everything.
Oh.
But within the setting, Rigard, people thinking, gosh, that bloke, yeah, is a greater reward than wealth. And it is one that many games take less seriously. They don't have mechanics for it. They don't have... I'm just, yeah, you can spend an awful lot of money getting people to follow you around and saying, gosh, aren't you wonderful? And the moment you stop spending, they go away.
That's sad, that is.
And it seems to me that a sufficiently serious hero, you know, somebody whose deeds are well known, somebody who went on the first expedition to the Pleiades, for example. Yes, I have just finished running Bayard with the group involving Mike. is going to be taken seriously in a whole lot of situations. Simply, you know, in GURPS terms, it's reputation. How many people recognise you and how often do they recognise you?
Yeah, there's a similar stat in RuneQuest Glorantha. It should be noticed that my character, having gone to the Pleiades and back, decided that he wanted to go somewhere quiet where nobody knew him and nobody will recall what it was he did.
And in 10 years' time, there's going to be a small band of desperate people coming up your mountain.
in 10 years' time, there will be lots of YouTube videos saying, whatever happened to Jeremy Hardesty? this only makes me think of the stress of Her Regard, which is a Tim Powers novel about vampires and rather good. Well, about sort of vampires, anyway, and rather good. The regard of somebody too exalted might be too much for mere mortals to bear, is what this made me think. But Roger, having just given an advertisement for the advertising industry, perhaps that's not what that means.
So, number 15 is endurance.
There's no one with endurance like the man who sells insurance. It's mostly a term for physical capacity, the ability to keep buggering on at whatever it is you're doing. It can be mental and it can be physical. It's those reserves that we use up when we've been doing too much GMing, I think. It's purely physical endurance is predominantly what it means, but mental endurance, stick-to-itiveness, is also a quality that role-playing games should model, or should be able to model if it becomes important.
Yeah, I found myself thinking, you know, most games have something like hit points, or you know, the degree to which you are injured. Many have fatigue or willpower or some sort of, you're not actually injured, but for some whatever reason you can't go on. Most of them, and I will give GURPS an honourable exception here, just assume that you can keep going at full strength until you fall over, and that really isn't so.
Yeah, fatigue drops, and especially at my age, there is only so far you can go before you have to sit down and take a rest. I think that may be true for young, very, very healthy people, which neither of us have been for for a length of time. But even they,
we have historical examples of this. You know, the soldiers who are told to march to the limit of their endurance, they are going to slow down before they fall over.
They're going to. It is probably possible for you to march yourself to death, and I'm fairly certain people manage to do it. March or Die. March or Die. March and Die is also an alternative. I think we might be seeing, as there has become a greater distinction in the types of mental injury people can take, the type of mental reserves that they have to resist that sort of stress and injury, there might be an increase in the types of physical reserve that people have. Endurance rather than hit points, fatigue rather than injury. I don't think you probably want to model more than about two factors. Three is going to get complicated and people will forget what they're talking about.
Well, I can think of one game that does three, a whole family of games called Cthulhu Eternal. I'll think of Cthulhu Eternal particularly because I've just been writing about it. You have your hit points, physical injury. You have your willpower, which is a combination, really, of fatigue and mental fortitude. Mm. And then you have your sanity, which is I'm actually going mad as a result of the frightful things I've seen.
Yeah, that's. I think that's one purely physical, one purely mental, and a meld of the two.
Yeah, in Call of Cthulhu, I think what becomes willpower is effectively magic points, but it got increasingly used as nothing to do with magic. Let's just see, you know, how long can you keep climbing this mountain, that kind of thing.
Does it regrow?
Oh yeah, it heals faster than hit points.
That seems reasonable. All right, what's next? Composure.
Now, the first thing I wrote on this was vital for the GM, and then I realised another of my universal meta rules, which is, if you corpse me, I will give you a bonus point.
Yeah,
I want to encourage that at the table. whatever form a bonus point takes. Within the game, I think it is something that is generally assumed. Again, Cthulhu honourable exception here, where the source material is all about seeing things that frighten you and gradually going mad. But I think more generally in what you might call the wargame-derived strain.
Yes.
While most wargames of the sort that they were building off have something like morale for massed troops, you know, the point at which the guys in the back start saying, sod this, I think I'll take my chances. It's something I've met heavily resisted among players of individual characters, I think, because the idea is they want to decide when their character would break. And in a system that doesn't define that, they want to be able to say, well, I can take it. I will stick it through to the end.
I will be the hero who dies surrounded by his foes, seems to be the assumption. As you'll have noticed, I tend to play characters who are a little more cautious than that. It's the fact. I tell you where the breakpoint comes. It's the fact that when panic spreads through a unit they're in, the PCs don't catch it, and they really should.
Mm.
Fairly sure somebody will tell us that there's a system which models this and models it well. But
I've rarely met systems that will take account of the possibility of the PC being a member of a unit rather than a distinct leader, hero figure, to be fair. War for Rollmaster did it.
Mm.
But I don't remember what that had to say about morale.
The gift we give to players is agency in worlds that don't exist. And they want agency, they don't want it taken from them. The fact they will put up with fright checks is actually a major step forward in getting them to accept that their characters are but mortal.
I think some of this, again, is the adversarial GM thing. And, you know, I do not want my character to show any weakness because any weakness can be exploited. Whereas what I think I would want to say as a normal GM, I can't really say normal if I'm contrasting this, a non-adversarial, a pro-player GM, is, yes, you are going to wave your hands in the air and run round in small circles saying, struck by lightning, struck by lightning. But in turn, I'm not going to use that to get you eaten by the monster. This is part of your character's story, and we can take it on from there rather than saying, oh, you failed in some way, the story is over.
Yeah, and on the other hand, you really should, once you've given them the hint, saying, look, the other side is coming towards you with bayonets fixed, and they're not pausing, and you can hear the people behind you running. I think if he doesn't take the hint, you really are obliged to kill him quite horribly. Heroically, posthumous VC, certainly, but...
I think it is fair utterly. To say that at least most of the people I play with are well aware that when your unit is routing, being the last bloke standing there is not a survival move.
Yeah.
I mean, routing is also not a survival move, but it's not quite as bad.
As long as there's somebody absorbing the initial damage, you can make it.
Number 17 is intensity.
Intensity. Intensity means to make things more important, to up the stakes. Something your players may resist. You say, yes, but if you do that, you risk losing your weapon. Yes, but if you do that, you expose yourself to the saliva of the monster, which may burn you in turn. You should give them fair warning, and you should explain the stakes, but you should not always listen to them saying, yeah, no, surely it isn't that serious. Surely I have rubber gloves on. I'm a professional adventurer. Of course I have arm-length rubber gloves on. Yes. So no monster saliva will bother me.
I was thinking of character intensity, interpersonal intensity, which is a great way to make even a quite positive character suddenly just a bit creepy. That they are absolutely focused on the one thing in the entire world that matters, and maybe it is you, and that can be terrifying.
True that. Or maybe you get the person who's on your side currently, but who has an agenda of their own and goes off and shows what his real motivations are and what he's going to do after this particular trivial little adventure is over. I'm thinking of Olav Tryggvason, gentleman adventurer from Girl Genius, who is currently exposing... I think he's about to do something spectacular and maybe save his... Maybe save his ally at the cost of his own life. He's a character who I suspect has been looking for a good death for quite some considerable time. Next is directness.
As a tactic, I would say most effective when unexpected, but that is because my very overall feeling is that if the conflict is resolved by who has the bigger number, that is not an interesting conflict.
True. What sort of conflicts are more interesting?
Yes, they can beat us on the battlefield, and therefore we need to be sneaky. I think I'm just embedded in the Western storytelling tradition. Robin Hood.
Yeah.
But also the mythology of the Second World War, to a large extent. Here is this huge organisation opposed to us, and therefore we need to be sneaky rather than just immediately invading France.
Yeah. Invading France generally takes a bit of a run-up, at least any time later than the Hundred Years' War. It needs preparation, really. But, I was thinking of being direct with the players, communicating with them clearly. Mm-hmm. I think English gamers and the English GMs and players have a tendency towards circumlocution. I certainly have. And I think sometimes I've said something clearly, and the other players, especially the ones down the far end of the table, have not heard what I think I've said plainly. So sometimes I just have to be blunt. Yes, if you do it, there's a chance you will die. What's next?
Number 19 is desire.
Well, bear in mind always, you can't always get what you want. To quote the Bard Jagger.
But if you
Jagger,
try, sometimes, you might you can, just find.
Yeah, well, yes, you can get what you need sometimes. But I also see Sir Philip Sidney's within myself to seek only, my only hire, desiring naught but how to kill desire. Desires are useful things for characters to have. They are defining their character's purposes. They are leading up to their grand climax, especially if it is, my name is Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die. Desire is a good thing to have, but it also ought to be a torture, or ought to be pain. It ought to be, I don't think that enlightened Buddhists make good player characters in role-playing games.
In Goethe's terms, it is a disadvantage. I care about getting this particular thing, and therefore that is going to constrain my actions, which as far as I'm concerned is the essence of a GURPS disadvantage. It takes away your free choices in sub-situation.
Yeah. And there are the motivations which have crept into Cthulhu gaming recently. The things that are there to explain why the hell you are going down to the old haunted mansion with a crate full of unstable dynamite.
Why can't they keep it in the house?
It's hunting the great old ones and their minions is not a sane and sensible thing to be doing. You need a powerful motivation. But again, that's also going to destroy you.
I would also mention Traveller. I don't know which bit of Traveller first had this. I met it in the Starter Traveller set, which was largely compiled from other books. But it talked about, when it's talking about how to run campaigns, it talks about the push, you know, here is the thing the characters ought to avoid. And then three things that to me always kind of blended into each other, the pull, the gimmick, and the enigma. I think the idea is the gimmick is a thing you want to get hold of in the short term, as it might be a shiny piece of equipment that you can't just buy, or knowing where the Psionics Institute is, or that kind of thing. The enigma, I think, tends to be the overall campaign plot, the thing you're going to gradually get involved with. And the pull, as I say, these blend into each other for me. We want to know more, we want to have more stuff, we're going to follow the trail that seems to lead towards that.
Yeah.
One thing they did say there, which I think is worth bearing in mind, is have several of them, rather than just, we must follow this because it is the thing we're following.
You need a group motivation and you need individual motivations as well.
But ideally multiple group motivations, so they feel they have a choice.
Yeah, but that leads them off down different paths and you can't plan for all of them. So, what's next? Promise.
I was thinking about the unspoken promise at the table, or at least for me it's unspoken. I think some groups may do this more formally. As far as I'm concerned, it would be something along the lines of, we are all here to have fun and we are not going to deliberately spoil that for each other.
Yes, I don't know. I don't know if I've ever said this to my group or any of my groups. I have sort of assumed it. If I were doing something with neophytes, new people, I would say, please play together and not purely separately. Please play your characters individually as well as you can, but also bear in mind that you're part of this group and you have comrades.
Yeah, I think it's even if you have players who already know the right sort of media that you're basing your game from, which you probably do these days, Most things, most stories have a fairly small group of principal characters, and even an ensemble show like the CSIs, you usually might only have two or three of them in a scene together. I wonder if there is a good literary antecedent for the entire party stays together and does stuff.
I can't think of one off the top of my head. Most narratives have single focus protagonists and hangers-on. I mean, it wouldn't be Don Quixote without Sancho Panza. But Sancho...
But they don't bring Dulcinea along as well.
Yeah, no. Dulcinea is there to be admired from a distance, which is a damn boring thing to have to do in a role-playing game. I was thinking of Promise maybe as a game mechanic. It happens in some LARPs, I think, that you can have a Promise token, a thing that you can ask one player to do one time up to this intensity, and it's not a tradable thing, it's something they owe you personally, but the timing of when you use it and how you use it makes the game very different from run to run.
I think I would probably think of that as a favour, but yes, that's definitely the same idea.
Yeah.
Number 21 is charity.
That's another one of those damned Christian virtues, dash it all.
Yeah.
It can become an obsession for some people. It is definitely an obsessive, compulsive skill, trait, disadvantage in GURPS. I suspect that the person who is full of charity either has had a call from a god or is trying to prove something to themselves. Or they could just be a good person. I came across a story about the founding general of the Salvation Army who went to one of his sons, who was also in the mission, and said, "There are these people sleeping underneath the bridges. They have no homes." "Well, yes, Father, they would be." "Well, do something about it," he said. Mm. And they did.
Yeah, I think these days we are used to rich people being sufficiently isolated that they don't care what people think of them. But as late as the 1920s, it is regarded as the rich person's duty to help people who need it in some way. You know, whether that's you or me giving money to a beggar, whether that's somebody supporting a charity that rescues unfortunates, whether it's Gladstone taking fallen women off the street.
Oi. Sorry, that was an oi.
Or whether it is building concert halls and libraries.
Which is Carnegie's.
Which is not necessarily going to make up for the harm you've done, but it is a thing you are expected to do. And if he hadn't done it, people would have thought, that was a really weird thing he didn't do. Why didn't he do that?
Nowadays, you can endow a private foundation and use it to keep from paying tax. I will note that the things that the very rich person does usually reflect on their own ego, but that's not necessarily a disadvantage. If you're saving people in an area that you're interested in, then you're still saving people. And everybody has ideas of what they want to do with your money.
Yeah, you will remember that New Hall remained New Hall until they found a graduate who was prepared to pay them a large amount of money to have their name put on it, which, fair enough.
I suppose. It's not as euphonious. It's not as traditional. It irked me when it happened.
I don't like the renaming of things in general, but that's me.
That was charity. Next is grit.
Is this just endurance by another name? Well, if we say yes, it's a very short thing, so let's say no. Is it the ability, perhaps, not to complain even as you are running out of endurance?
Yeah, I've got here is it's the thing that gets into your eye or inside your shoe and makes your life miserable.
In Finnish, of course, it is sisu, which is like grit, only even more so.
Because
they're Finns and they're tough. And look your arms off. Oh, so it is.
Okay.
Number 23, fortune.
The reason that we like dice or cards for eccentrics, the thing that makes the universe real or imagined, uncertain. I've been reading E.M.W. Tilliard's The Elizabethan World Picture. He goes on and on about precisely how fortune interacts with the influence of the stars and the will of God. To boil down to just sit there and take it, all right. You're going to have to, just going to have to endure what fortune sends you. And it's how you react to it that matters, not whether you win or lose.
But also, casting the Queen's horoscope is a capital crime.
Unless she asks you to. It's all right if she asks you to. John D got kicked out by the next administration. He did not get himself executed.
From the randomness point of view, there have been a couple of occasions on which I thought, you know, I could be self-indulgent or not, and that I would ask the dice, and the dice have given me a very clear answer. One of them, in fact, was in the climactic die-rolling of the Bayern game, when two of the characters were combining on a particularly finicky technical task, which, had it gone badly, could have produced major bad side effects, as they were well aware, and they both rolled superbly well. I'm also thinking of the incident in the World War II game, I may have mentioned this before, a new royal princess has appeared, though the player characters are among the very few people who realise that she is new and she didn't exist yesterday. Everybody else thinks she's always been there. They went to have a look at her and try to work out what was going on. And the film star fighter pilot hero decided to introduce himself to her. He rolled a critical success on his sex appeal. She rolled a natural 18 best possible reaction to him. By the end of the campaign, they were engaged to be married. They weren't getting married during the war, obviously.
You old romantic, you. I will note
this meant he became much less inclined to send her back where she'd come from.
True that. Natural self-defensiveness of the Tulpa, or something like that. I will note that in the scenario yesterday, you did not defend me from the consequences of crashing the shuttle we were arriving on. And
still
also
breathing, aren't you?
Yeah, all right, fair enough. You also said that you hated the end result that the scenario seemed to be trying to force you to. So maybe you're using your own telekinesis remotely on the player's dice. What's next? Distance.
A journey should be interesting. If a journey is not interesting, it should be elided. This is a more general case of players should constantly be faced with interesting and meaningful choices. But also, I think a lot of early RPGs were happy to fall into resource management minigames.
Yes.
You have to get from here to here. How are you going to spend your resources? What route are you going to take? All that kind of thing. Yes, but I want to do that stuff in character.
Yeah. I am currently reading Stonetop, which is a Dungeon World reskin with a lot more background and mechanics in it. And it has lots of mechanics about journeying to this place, journeying to that place, how to survive against the stresses of travelling through a dangerous world. And the thing is that you use that to... It's prejudiced in favour of using that to make interesting journeys and interesting things happen. I'm not sure how it'll play. I certainly want to give it a try. What I thought of with distance is the fact that I am really rotten at imagining range, and is the creature within range of the player's weapons? Do I have to decide that right now? It's not... I have a clear mental picture for me in my head of what's been happening in the run-up to the players readying their weapons. But I don't know if I've described it clearly to them, and I don't know if I've imagined it clearly enough for me. I don't have a natural sense of what 200 metres is, what 20 metres is. I know what right in your face is, because I've had that happen to me. But I find that terribly difficult, and I don't know how I can train myself out of it. But there we go.
With the Cambridge group, we don't generally play with a map, but we developed the convention that anybody can say, could I have a sketch map of the situation, please? And then pause the game and I will do that. 25 is familiarity.
It breeds contempt, you know. It mostly comes up in my games when people say, am I familiar with this weapon, with this computer, with these people's customs? Sometimes the game system will give you an answer. Sometimes the logic of the story will do it. You should probably be generous if it doesn't include a factor that will kill the mystery or the story, or is an ill-timed red herring. A well-timed red herring is a beautiful thing, but an ill-timed red herring is going to mean you're going to spend the last hour of the game chasing this squirrel all over the place.
Squirrel.
Better... Where? Better if you give out partial information than none, but not a false solution unless they have an ability that they can point to justifying that, knowing that. I think allowing their information to be partly controlled by dice rolls makes the game more interested. It moves it in directions I hadn't thought I was going to have to go sometimes, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But am I familiar with this? Wouldn't I know about this? Some game systems, the current version of Unknown Armies, has a fairly generous penumbra of things you can do with a trait that aren't the trait itself. I'm a firefighter. Of course I can. A large number of things would be justified after that, and they encourage you. And in my Glorantha game, we're from the borders. What we know about this particular cult is something they say a lot of. And sometimes I say, you're from the borders. You don't know about that particular cult. It's unique to the city.
Oh, yeah, you know about them. They come and raid and they eat your babies.
Yes, that's a useful piece of misinformation. Actually, it's probably accurate with the trolls, but be fair.
I was thinking about the familiarity of the home base, of the place where you take the break between the adventure in settings where that's happening. And, of course, one can subvert this, but the subversion only works if it was real in the first place.
True.
Thinking of a lot of the agency games and shows, you know, you are working for the boss who says, here is your mission of the week.
Yeah.
You can have an episode in which the agency is subverted, but you need to establish how it normally works first to have that, to make that have an effect.
Hmm. According to my dictionary that I just looked up, it is only based on family or household remotely. It derives from familiaris, friendly or domestic. Which I think is, I can see why that becomes what it means today. What is next? Next is number 26, which is yours, regret.
Well, as we were saying earlier about loss, I think it is rare in games. I think I would like to see, and I may try to insert into games I run, more hard choices where you cannot simply cut through the knot and have it all. You have to pick one of these things is gonna happen and the other one is not. And the classic heroic dilemma would be, do I go for future happiness for myself or save the kingdom? But whatever form it takes, two things you genuinely want and you cannot have both.
I think regret is interesting as a background. A thing that happened before the game starts. The thing that the character regrets doing and is going to spend the rest of his time compensating for. Severus Snape in Harry Potter betrayed his one true love to her death and has spent his entire life after that, up to his death, proving something or other to himself.
So number 27 is hunger.
This is something I have done my best not to experience. Most people in Western societies will never experience it unless they go on weight-reducing diets or join the SAS or something equally eccentric. I'm not sure if we model it well in RPGs, because like dying of disease, it's not an interesting problem. It doesn't lead to stories. If you are really fucking hungry, then yes, you will steal the loaf of bread. Yes, you will not be the person you think you are if you're really hungry. But I don't know that we model it terribly well. I think true hunger will cause a breakdown of self-control, and that, as we said earlier, is something that players hate.
In a more wilderness context, hunger is a sign that you planned the trip wrong.
Yep.
Or it could be a sign that things have changed. You know, we're crossing the plains. We ought to be able to forage these particular sort of mushrooms. These particular sort of mushrooms are not growing here. What is wrong? What has changed? Why aren't they here?
We have just acquired two more party members, and we're going to have to eat somebody if we're going to make it home.
Well, that's why we had the intern.
28. Devotion.
I think it is generally held to flow towards the PCs.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
From the henchmen or whatever, their followers.
Hey,
All my NPC
henchmen are union members and are liable to sit down at a moment's notice.
The thing I find more interesting is, what and whom do the PCs care about? What are they devoted to? Whether individuals, institutions, principles. It's not because I want to use this as a lever. I'm not John Wick. I want to know what goals they hold beyond I want to get rich and powerful.
Yeah.
What are they... Yeah, we can assume that most people want to get rich and powerful, or at least rich and powerful enough that they don't have to worry about whatever it is they worry about.
Yeah.
But what are they working towards?
It's... That is good for modelling the end... the motivations for keeping them doing the hard grind of whatever it is the game is about. RuneQuest models this very well with devotion is an emotion you feel to your family, to your god, to your employer, to your unit. In the RuneQuest game, I'm just finishing writing up, all but one of the player characters chose to return to their unit rather than take up the promise of better status and better jobs in the capital. Only one of them said, yeah, I have changed enough. I think I should stay here and become somebody else. And I think that was also something they drew upon to augment their skills and their spells and their abilities. And that makes it, with the possibility you fail and are cast into a pit of despair, makes it an interesting mechanic to have in the game.
So, 29, labour.
Spelt the British way, so that makes me think of the Labour Party. And I wonder if you could write a campaign about the early days of socialism in the UK and how you could then taint it with unnatural things. Perhaps discovering that the Tories and Liberals are the puppets of ancient inhuman overlords. I'm not at all serious. I could take this seriously, but it might make a good one-off, you know.
I think Labour, the boring, non-dangerous grunt work, is generally regarded in games as something for the little people. We don't have to worry about it. I do have a lot of time for the broad concept of these ordinary neglected maintenance techs are the guys who save the ship in this one shot.
Yeah, you know the quote from Man and Superman. The Tanner's friend says to his chauffeur, I have a great respect for the dignity of labour. And the chauffeur says, that's because you've not ever done any, sir.
Eh.
Number 30. Pride.
Okay, in our acculturation, this is regarded as a flaw. In a heroic culture, you are supposed to be proud. You are supposed to say, yeah, I've got to the top. Look at me. I don't think we do that enough in games.
Oh.
There is that clash between what we grow up believing in the real world and what the culture encourages. As a player and GM, I like to think I'm reasonably good at what I do, but I try not to be proud about it.
Pride is one thing. Vanity is another. And vanity is a lot easier to do. And as somebody we could all mention demonstrates, once you've set off down the road of vanity, it's not long until you enter the realm of vainglory and you believe your own bullshit. I think...
I use the classical Greek model of Timae Hubris Nemesis. And yeah. The key thing about that is once you start on the path, it is inevitable unless you die first. You are going to get over too much belief in yourself and eventually die of it.
I take the point of view that pride is for things you achieve. Vanity is about the things you have anyway. Some people have told me this, a nice sounding and resonant voice. And I am slightly vain about it. I try to keep this under control. I can only be proud about the things that I've said with it, but I can't be proud about something that hormones and life gave me without my asking. And it's this is the reason that I say patriotism is vanity for most people. It isn't pride. They haven't done anything to be a British or American or French. They've inherited it. They were given it on a plate. And it is vanity of the worst kind to exalt yourself because of it. The only people who can feel true patriotism are people who have chosen to become part of a nation and have been naturalized and legally part of that nation. And that's why I agree that patriotism is not, I say patriotism is not the last resort of the scoundrel. It's the first bloody resort of the scoundrel nowadays. And yeah, pride is a sin, and it's a very difficult sin not to do.
I think your model may also help to explain why many business leader types like to say, you know, I came from nothing, I pulled myself up, and you can do it too, while not mentioning, while living in a flat that my parents were paying for and borrowing money from granddad to get my first company started, and. Yeah. Number 31, Edge.
Edge. The place where adventure happens, living on the edge. It's also the thing that cuts into flesh and other resisting subjects. I seem to recall one version of HeroQuest had Edge as an enhancement to the main skill mechanic, and it made a skill more effective but not more powerful, which is neat now that I think about it. I think, Edge weapons do more damage in GURPS, but not as much damage as impaling weapons. But impaling weapons have a lower base damage, but they double the amount of damage it gets through the armour. Whereas if you swing an edged weapon, it cuts harder and deeper, but it only multiplies the damage by 1.5. Living on the edge is a very peculiar concept. It's something that games like the Forge in the Dark games do well. I'm not sure it appeals to me even as a power fantasy because it feels too damn dangerous. I think I'm getting nervous in my old age, Governor. I think I really am.
In GURPS, it is a 15-point disadvantage.
Really?
You take grossly unreasonable risks in the face of mortal danger.
Living on the edge, oh yes.
Make a self-control roll whenever you face a life-threatening situation. If you fail, you may not back down from the challenge.
Yeah, none of my players have ever taken that one. Some of them have behaved as if they have it anyway, but none of them have ever taken that one.
My thought on this is that edges are largely a human construct.
Oh, yes.
In environments, in people's demographics and so on, you generally don't get a hard edge unless it has been put there by a human. You get a fuzzy boundary in which things gradually shift away from one and towards the other.
Yeah. Frontiers are the concept of a human mind, and it only occasionally run along naturally formed lines. There is the edge of any society, the place which is technically inside the society, but which they doesn't quite reach fully, and it doesn't quite support fully. The people living there are probably going to be criminals out of necessity.
Well, out of definition, surely, because if they were able to exist entirely within the society, they wouldn't have to be. They would not be criminals.
I think you are confusing. They move to the edge, or find themselves on the edge, and then they become criminals, and then the society says, "Yup, see, I told you so. We probably ought to pass a law against that sort of behaviour."
Well, you'll know about them. So that is RPG A Day for 2026.
How fast did we get through? Oh my goodness, we've been prolix.
Never mind.
Nothing to see here.
Onward.
If you have any thoughts upon our thoughts and contributions you feel you ought to make, or pointers you'd like to give us to what you wrote, or performed, or did during RPG A Day, we'd be very interested to hear from you.
Leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.li.
I will be back again, hopefully in a cooler month, next time.
Would be nice.